KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to interview one of my fellows, pun intended, Larry Downes, the author of the new book, The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age, published by Basic Books. A pervasive topic on Hearsay Culture, in fact, perhaps it's a formative principle, is that we examine the impact of law and technology on society and how technology has changed our interactions, what we do with this new technology, and how law deals with those issues. And we've drilled down on intellectual property law in particular, primarily because it's my area, and it's an area that is very fast-moving and is in large measure shaping how technology is used and where technology is going. In Larry's book, The Laws of Disruption, he spends his time in his book outlining basically nine major areas where his law of disruption impacts our life. Now, what is a law of disruption? Well, Larry will discuss it in more detail, but he defines it in his book as technology changes exponentially, but social, economic, and legal systems change incrementally. That is, as he will discuss in more detail, the law of disruption. And in his book, The Laws of Disruption, he covers three primary areas, each one having three subsets. The three primary areas are private life, public life, and information life. Under private life, we have the dealings in convergence, in other words, how technologies have impacted our private lives themselves, that interaction. He deals with issues of personal information and human rights. In the public life area, he discusses infrastructure, business, and crime. And information life, he covers copyright, patents, and open source primarily, or just the sharing of software and software-related issues and intellectual property. Now, there are any number of issues that we could discuss when we think about what we mean by disruption, and this idea of disruption comes from primarily Joseph Schumpeter's work dealing with disruptive issues and disruptive technologies and also rules of innovation and so forth. And so Schumpeter himself has, and his work has been focused on very heavily over the last 10, 15, 20 years in a wide variety of areas that deal with how technologies now change our economic relationships and how innovation occurs in the world in 2009. In Larry's book, there are any number of areas that we could cover, and we're going to drill down on a few of them. But what Larry, I think, is attempting to achieve in this book is to outline where these major areas exist where the law, perhaps, is not keeping up with the changes that we see in technology and the impact of those changes on our social relationships and on our government and on ultimately our world. So it's a very, very broad area. And it's an area that can't be easily covered in one book, but I think Larry does a good job discussing many of these areas and trying to, and I think doing well, tying together this law of disruption and showing how that law impacts these various areas. So, with that basic introduction, the best thing to do now is to bring Larry on the air. So, Larry, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back.
Let's start off, and I appreciate you pointed out your early support of the show, and I appreciate you coming back here. I make the invitation to a number of guests to come back, and I've been able to do that now, so that's a nice thing. We did mention this last time, but let's discuss a little bit more how you came to focus on writing this particular book. What was there a particular event or reason that brought you to putting your work into the laws of disruption?
There really was. I mean, I have been teaching and doing scholarship on and off on both areas of business strategy and on law, and particularly technology law, for many years. But largely, those were kind of two separate areas of interest for me. One of the things, though, I started to notice, particularly a couple of years ago, as I was reading through the mainstream media about technology and clipping stories that I thought were interesting in terms of how strategy was being affected by technology, was that I noticed that more and more of those stories turned out to be stories about law, and either that was in the form of, you know, litigation or new regulatory proceedings or actual, you know, laws being passed. And increasingly, what I found was that innovation in general, but particularly innovation having to do with information technology, was being strongly determined, I would say skewed or even warped, by increasing amounts of interference from the law of the industrial world.
And by that law, we mean what?
Well, as I say, you know, anything having to do with traditional legal proceedings, so lawsuits about competition or antitrust proceedings by the European Union, or, you know, threats of new laws to influence consumer privacy. All these things were increasingly starting to affect the way in which new technology is being deployed, how it's being marketed, and really, from a consumer standpoint, how it's being used.
Yeah, now, I should have mentioned in the introduction that you're a partner with the Bell Mason Group, and which is a consulting firm focused on corporate innovation and venturing, as well as being a fellow with Stanford, and you've written quite a bit in this area. Your background, though, merging this interest with the very real functional world of being a consultant and focusing on the ideas of innovation and growth of businesses is one that I think is something that we can explore in a little more detail. How does that experience inform your work in this area?
Well, I mean, you know, if I have a sort of mission in this book, the key mission is to get non-lawyers to understand the important impact that law is having on the innovation process, and particularly my clients who are executives, a lot of them in technology companies, but some of them in just heavily information-intensive industries like financial services and so on. They really have isolated and kind of cordoned off law for a long time and for many reasons. They see that as a separate activity that's done by the lawyers. They leave it aside. It doesn't really influence their decision-making about new products or new investments or new activities. And the message I'm trying to get across is that that is no longer a viable approach to thinking about law. The law has become so invasive in the innovation process, for better, largely for worse, but in any event, it's something that all executives have to take note of and to take into consideration as they're developing strategic plans. At the same time, the message for lawyers is that they also have to change the way they think about the rest of the business that they're involved in. Even this is both for corporate lawyers and outside counsel. They have to step up and become more a part of the strategy process. And I liken to this to sort of an analogy to 10 years ago when the Internet first started to become a commercial platform for business. There was a very similar kind of relationship that executives had with the chief information officer of the company. That was seen as a support function, non-strategic. You know, we finish our plans, we kind of throw them over the wall, and the CIO is responsible for building whatever the systems are that we need to support the plans. With the sort of disruptive potential of the Internet, that model stopped working. And now I think, you know, after 10 years of struggling with it, most companies do understand that the chief information officer has to be part of the strategy function in terms of determining what gets done. My thesis in this book is the same kind of change now has to happen for the legal team and the legal department. They too have to become part of the strategy, for better or for worse.
You talk, since you brought it up here, I think it's a good way to get into the book. You spend some time in the book talking about the role of the lawyer, and you've just mentioned it here. And in that discussion, you raise a concern about lawyers ultimately not being involved in these kinds of business strategy decisions. And that's something that is an interesting critique and an interesting issue in terms of the role of the lawyer. You know, because traditionally, and by traditionally, I mean certainly several decades ago, lawyers, at least in that context, viewed themselves as advisors on the law, as opposed to intricate players in the decision-making of the entity whom they were advising, either in-house or as outside counsel. So their job was not to strategize, but it was to advise on the law and ultimately, as you point out in the book, oftentimes tell the business that they could not do what they wanted to do. How does the law or the laws of disruption impact that relationship? Because certainly one view could say that the lawyer's role should be merely to enforce the law, that that is their job.
Yeah, well, I think that's, as you say, it's an old method of thinking about the role of law and lawyers, and in my view, it's an outdated, and frankly, it's quite a dangerous way of looking at it. There are increasingly a number of situations where the very existence, the sort of life or death of the business, depends on how the outcome of what might have thought as unpredictable or unexpected legal turns. So you think about a couple years ago when the makers of the BlackBerry, Research in Motion, they got into a patent dispute, and ultimately, you know, the company was nearly shut down because they were not able to reach a settlement with the other party. Same thing happened, by the way, to Vonage and its patents disputes about voice over IP technology. There's more of this all the time. Some of this litigation, particularly for younger companies or for startup companies, this litigation can be life or death. And if, you know, your lawyer's kind of taking a hands-off approach and saying, well, you know, we'll worry about that, or, you know, we'll litigate it, don't worry about it, keep running the business, and so on, this is just no longer viable, and the business itself may cease if you make bad decisions in terms of the law.
How does a lawyer, and I think, well, you know, before we get into that, I think a little more background is in order, because I do want to push back a little bit on this very interesting question of what lawyers are to do in the current economy. But before we get to that, I gave a very brief description, and reading directly from your book, of how you define the law of disruption. But the book is called The Laws of Disruption, plural. So what are, in sum, the laws of disruption? What are we focusing on here?
Well, my view is that because of the sort of, you know, big difference in how quickly technology changes versus how slowly by design law changes, we're getting this bigger and bigger gap all the time between what the law says is how the world should work and what technology really has determined ought to be the way the world works. And as that gap gets bigger, we're going to have more and more of these conflicts. So the laws of disruption, the plural version of it, these are those nine areas you mentioned a moment ago where I see the biggest sets of conflicts already happening. Now, these are sort of, if you think of this as a war between kind of the law of the industrial age and the emerging law of the information age, these are the nine battleground states. So these are the nine places where there's the most contention and the most conflict, largely because this is where the most activity is, where the most money is, where the most consumer behavior is. These are the areas where we're going to see the most conflict and really, I think, where we'll work out, for better or for worse, a new way of thinking about law, really a new legal paradigm that fits much better with our information economy and our sort of digital lives.
You discuss in building to this point earlier very significant economic theories, including Moore's Law and Metcalfe's Law. For listeners that are not well-versed in economics or just want a refresher, what is Moore's Law and what is Metcalfe's Law, and how do those two earlier basic economic principles inform your work here?
So Moore's Law is in some ways a nice encapsulation of why digital technology is as disruptive as it's turned out to be. Gordon Moore, who was the founder of Intel, wrote a very influential article in the 1970s, and he said, you know, just given the technology of semiconductors, it would be possible every 12 to 18 months to double the number of transistors on a chip but hold the price constant, meaning that every 12 to 18 months, computing power, you know, roughly doubles, but the price stays the same. And in fact, another aspect of Moore's Law is that as that happens, the processing also gets smaller. So you have smaller, cheaper, faster computing all the time, and as the sort of driving commodity of digital technology, that's, you know, quite radical and quite revolutionary. You can't think of any previous technological revolution where the major technology component was something that got smaller and cheaper and faster on a, even a predictable level every 12 to 18 months. And it's held, Moore's Law has held quite nicely for, you know, some 30 years now, and every indication is that it'll keep going, you know, at least through the rest of my working lifetime, but probably for a long time in the future. The coupling principle that you mentioned with Moore's Law is Metcalfe's Law. This is from Robert Metcalfe, who was essentially the inventor of the Ethernet. And Metcalfe observed that the way that networks grow in terms of their value, sort of the network effects principle, is that the more people, the more devices, the more activities in a single network, the faster its value accelerates. So what he said was that the square of the number of users of a network was equal to roughly the value of that network. So that as you add the 100th person to a network of, say, telephones, you get 200 new telephone connections. If you add the 1,000,000th person, you get 2 million new each additional incremental person adds a significantly more value than the previous one, and that number continues to accelerate. Of course, the Internet is the network that we're talking about here. You put that together with Moore's Law, so everybody can have more computing power, faster and cheaper, smaller all the time. They can connect those computers together and interact with each other, and thanks to Metcalfe's Law, the more they do it, the more value that's being generated. You put those two together, and you have essentially an economic as well as a technological revolution.
We are talking with Larry Downes, author of the book The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Larry is joining us by telephone from California, and we are recording the show on Monday, November 2nd. Tracing this history, Larry, I think it's a fair question. I mentioned in the introduction of the other than those two esteemed economists, are there others' work that you feel you're building upon in analyzing where we are in 2009?
Well, you mentioned, I think, Joseph Schumpeter, and of course that's very important as well, his notion that the way in which capitalism works and capitalist systems work is not actually in kind of incremental improvements over time, but in big breaks, what he called these cycles of creative destruction. I think that's quite an accurate description for what's happening now, where we really are kind of replacing one set of industries and a model for thinking about industrial production with a new set of industries and a new way of thinking about production, a sort of information-based economy. Some of the players, of course, will find new life. In fact, some of them will find a better life as businesses in that new emerging economy. But it's a chaotic time, and I think everybody, you know, consumers included, appreciate the chaos. Some of the chaos is very good chaos. We get, you know, new applications, we get new devices, we get new technologies that suddenly go from zero to 200 million users, say, for example, in the case of Facebook or the iPhone. But that chaos, you know, from a business standpoint, makes it very difficult to do long-term planning and to make investments in assets, and particularly assets with a long depreciation cycle like factories and so on. And I think, you know, that's where Schumpeter comes in. Also, of course, I always pay homage to Ronald Coase and his work in transaction cost economics. That's also very important. He explains that the market is not as efficient for repeat transactions as businesses are. And one of the things that's been happening, and I wrote about this in some of my earlier books, is that as technology makes the market more efficient, the relationship between markets and businesses is changing, and the balance of power, if you will, is shifting more toward the market, less towards large, vertically integrated businesses. That, of course, is continuing to happen as technology goes through its cycles of Moore's Law and is, you know, something we see all the time in terms of how dynamics are happening in business.
You mentioned that you've written this area for a while, and you also write on it regularly, not just in books, but on you know, various blogs, including Stanford's blog, as well as your own website that we'll discuss shortly. And I'm interested, you know, having, you know, since when Unleashing the Killer Apps, one of your previous books, was published, and now, are you more concerned than you were, let's say, 5 years ago, that the law can deal with these rapid rapid changes. What's your state of mind today?
Very anxious. I am. No, I mean, as I say, I have noticed that increasingly law in all its forms, litigation, regulation, and so on, has become a significant influencer, I think a negative influencer, of how new technologies are introduced to the market, how consumers can use them or not use them. When we get to talking about copyright, of course, that's a key function. And I'm very concerned that we are on the precipice of a legal revolution, the transformation of a sort of industrial age body of law to an information age body of law. There have been, in history, many previous examples of this kind of legal shift, this kind of revolutionary change to match a new technological reality. And frankly, some of those shifts have been violent. Some of them have been not violent. I'm hopeful that the change we're going through right now will wind up being one of the nonviolent varieties. But depending on how, you know, kind of the existing infrastructure of law reacts or resists or tries to hold back the inevitable, the likelihood for more or less violent transformation changes with them.
Well, I think you've raised the specter of violence, which is, by that I think you mean physical violence, which is something we don't generally talk about in connection with intellectual property law issues. But you're talking about things much broader than that. So perhaps I'll push you on this and ask you to give an example of a scenario within the realm of the laws of disruption that you envision could lead to a violent outcome.
Well, you know, as has been said by the media industry, no one has gone to the barricades yet for copyright reform. But as information becomes increasingly the source of value in our economy, the likelihood that consumers will take up arms either physically or virtually, I think, increases tremendously. And I'll give you a recent example. I think about 6 months ago, Facebook, which, you know, now given 300 million users, makes it about the fourth largest country in the world, mm-hmm. if it was actually a physical place. About 6 months ago, Facebook, posted a notice, very, very understated, very modest, that they were making some changes to the terms of service agreement, which, if Facebook is a country, then the terms of service agreement is essentially its constitution. And there was a tremendous outcry by users about the nature of those changes. So, of course, this being Facebook, the users started a Facebook page called Facebook Users Against the New Terms of Service. And within a couple hours, they'd signed up 100,000 people, which, you know, for Facebook standards isn't very many. But, you know, if you can sort of imagine that kind of social protest in the real world, 100,000 people in a couple of hours is a pretty significant starting point. And Facebook, you know, to its credit, responded very quickly. First of all, they withdrew the proposed changes to the terms of service. More importantly, within a week or so, they announced that they were going to change the very way in which they make changes to the terms of service. They were going to, first of all, turn that document, which is dense, unreadable, legal mumbo-jumbo, they were going to turn it into something that was readable in English or whatever natural language the users prefer, and they were going to develop new changes or new versions of that document in collaboration with the user community, with the citizens of the nation of Facebook. I thought, you know, this was kind of a bloodless coup, and I don't want to take too much from a single incident or a single anecdote. But if you think about it, why would Facebook be so responsive? One reason is that as a social networking site, the entire value of the company is based on information provided by users.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, users can pick up and, you know, move to another social networking site without too much trouble. So if they don't keep those users happy, particularly in the sort of relatively early stage of the business, they could lose the whole show. So it was understandable from a business standpoint why they reacted that way, but I think as information becomes more valuable to business, and particularly user-provided information, you'll see more of the same kind of, you know, user revolts at unreasonable allocations of value, and you'll see essentially the emergence of user-developed bodies of law, you know, terms of service agreements and everything that comes with it, that will dictate just how that relationship between users and operators and users and each other is going to happen in this new information-based economy.
When you focus on the laws of disruption, the sense I get from the book is that the concern is that businesses have a difficult time dealing with the changing environment. But it doesn't appear that consumers have a difficult time with it, except where businesses screw up, as you indicate in the Facebook situation. So I guess I'm going to say something fairly basic, and you can tell me if I'm right. Is it a fair statement to say that as a general matter, consumers should be happy about the laws of disruption existing, whereas businesses should not?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think you're half right in the sense that, you know, consumers do adapt more quickly to the potential for disruptive technology than do businesses. And by the way, businesses adapt more quickly than do governments. But in some sense, it's good news, you know, for all of them. And there's a reason why we invent new technology. There's a reason why innovation is what drives the advance of civilization. Of course, not all technologies work out well. Some of them, you know, have negative consequences, and think about the environment and global warming. Some of them have systemic negative consequences that we have a difficult time internalizing in terms of figuring out what's good and what's bad and what we should and shouldn't use. But as a, you know, sort of a basic history of humankind story, technology has made life better, and it makes life better for everybody. The problem is, as I say, is that it doesn't move incrementally. It moves in these big waves, in these disruptive waves, and in many cases in chaotic waves. You're right that consumers have less trouble. They certainly don't have no trouble. They have less trouble than businesses in sort of making their way through the new world. Businesses can do it. It's harder for them. They have more inertia to overcome. But it shouldn't be seen as bad news to them, because these are the same technologies, again, that create new value and therefore new opportunities, new markets, new products, and new services.
We're talking with Larry Downes, author of the book, The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can go about making a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. In these hard times, I hope you will consider making a donation to keep the diverse program of KZSU on the air, and indeed to keep Hearsay Culture coming to you every Wednesday at 5 o'clock, and continuing to make sure that KZSU exists as a public resource for not only the Bay Area, but by way of the internet to the world. Larry, let's kind of circle back a little bit and focus directly on law and the role of lawyers. Pushing back on your previous point a little bit, that lawyers need to be intimately involved in strategic planning, one could, or tell me if I'm wrong, one could make the argument that lawyers themselves can oftentimes, because they are advising on the law, prevent bad decisions from being made. In other words, lawyers can prevent, for example, perhaps the cease and desist letter being sent out by an entity that has little or no merit. Now, of course, we know that these letters are oftentimes written by lawyers, so we assume that lawyers are doing their job ethically and honestly and aren't sending out frivolous letters. But is there an argument to be made that precisely because we are in a time of disruptive technology, of these radical changes in technology and the law not keeping up, that lawyers need to be that bulwark against just rampant change with little thought?
Well, that, of course, is the traditional role of lawyers in times of crisis and chaos, but it's not a very productive role, in my view. I don't think, you know, obviously I don't cast aspersions on my own profession, but I think a lot of lawyers do not act in the most, let's say, in the most non-cynical way. A lot of times, of course, litigation is initiated not because of the merits, but because they want to open a negotiating channel with some other company, or perhaps to get leverage in an ongoing negotiation. Just this last week, Nokia sued Apple over patents relating to cellular phone technology. I don't think anybody seriously takes that litigation as a sign that the two companies are at huge odds, and that the net result will be a determination of whether or not those patents are any good, or whether or not Apple has in fact infringed on them. It's obviously a ploy in an ongoing negotiation over royalties, using the courts, using the law as leverage. You know, this is what lawyers do today, particularly as it relates to new technology. I don't find that a particularly productive role. I understand, of course, why you have to do it. If the other people are doing it, you have to do it too, if nothing else, as a defensive measure. But, you know, lawyers can and historically do play a much more important role in helping to give birth to the new paradigm of law. I mean, you think about all the people who were involved in the U.S. Constitution. Many, if not most of them, were lawyers. The same could be said of previous generations of you know, legal transformation. Really, it's up to the lawyers not just to keep the chaos in check, but it's up to the lawyers, perhaps at the same time, you know, with one hand on the old buttons, to start inventing the new society that's going to eventually, if not inevitably, come, and probably come sooner than anybody thinks.
So, Larry, you know, I'm a law professor. I'm teaching first-year law students right now in Contracts 1, and for those of you that are not lawyers or have attended law school, this is a bread-and-butter first-year course in every single law school in the United States that is accredited, and is a bread-and-butter course really internationally in legal training. And I also teach internet law, which is a specific area focusing on and surveying a variety of internet law-related issues, from speech to trademark. What advice do you give me? What should I be teaching my students, given your insights, about their role when they graduate for the first years? We're talking about students that are going to graduate in 2012. What do I teach them about the laws of disruption? What would be the message?
Well, you might find it better just to ask them what they're going to teach you, because of course, as assuming most of them are under the age of 30.
That's right.
No matter how technologically savvy you and I are, and I'm sure that relative to our peer group in age, we are more technologically savvy. You know that your students know 10 times more than you do about technology and how it's being used and how it's not being used and what people really do and don't do with it. I'm sort of laughing because I'm thinking about my course in contracts as a first-year law student 15 years ago, and even then it seemed completely irrelevant. My professor in contracts was a fresh graduate from law school. I don't think she'd ever actually signed a contract, let alone negotiated a contract, and really didn't understand that the way in which 99% of all interactions, you know, even business interactions, take place, particularly between businesses and consumers, has nothing to do with the document that does or doesn't actually, you know, have enforceability embedded in it. Really, it has everything to do with what we're talking about with Facebook. It's how you want to deal with customers and what you're afraid of and what works and what doesn't work. The document, the sacred contract that's negotiated between two parties, and they have to have a meeting of minds, and all these other doctrines, it's just a bunch of baloney. It has almost nothing to do with how the world actually operates. Probably, you know, if anything, I would suggest helping your students to understand the role played by the document versus the role not played by the document, so at least they appreciate where it fits into a broader context of how human beings organize and manage their relationships with each other, both business and non-business.
So to the extent that I have current students that are listening to this show, I need to tell you that I will be testing you on everything we discussed up to now, including offer and acceptance consideration, notwithstanding Larry's concern that it doesn't move us in the direction that we need to go, and that you'll need to go and practice. So there's my disclaimer, Larry, for the students that are currently listening to the show. Let me ask you this. You, in connection with law, you talk about how we reroute lawsuit around inefficient laws, and how consumers ultimately, and even businesses to some degree, get around failures in law creation. And I think that's an interesting idea. And you discuss it in connection with another term, which you call anti-law. So perhaps I'll ask you about this idea of rerouting an anti-law. What is it, and how does it fit into your analysis?
Well, let me start with anti-law, because I think that's sort of the precursor to the discussion about rerouting. I talk about a couple of examples where legislators in particular have done the right thing in terms of dealing with disruptive technologies. I think one of the best examples of what I call anti-law is the Section 230 of the Communications Act of 1996, which essentially provides cover for websites and blogs and pretty much anybody offering an internet service, that they can't be held responsible the way a traditional publisher would be for anything that users might post to their site. So if they, you know, if they defame somebody in a blog comment, or if they offer a counterfeit merchandise on eBay, whatever it is, the actual person running the website, Craigslist and so on, they're not responsible as a publisher for what their users do and don't put on the website. And I don't know that Congress really had the foresight that I'm going to give them credit for to say why that was an essential thing in order to get Web 2.0 and social networking going. But in fact, I think it was essential, because if you imagine, you know, billions of interactions going on Facebook and MySpace and Twitter today, or you can think about, you know, how that would never really have happened if somehow the operators of those sites had to police the content before it was posted and after, you know, in any way, shape, or form, be involved in the actual content itself. And in fact, you know, it's not a coincidence to say that in, you know, the United States, which has this broad immunity principle built in that said, you know, we will not hold law accountable to these operators, we have all those successful social networking companies outside the U.S., places like the U.K. in particular, Australia in particular, where the opposite principle holds, which is to say website operators can be held responsible, you don't have those kinds of companies. They have not flourished there, absent that kind of broad immunity. So I like this idea of, you know, sort of carving out areas where new developments are happening. We don't know what they're going to look like. We want to give them space to develop, to deploy, to interact with users, and essentially we pass laws saying we will not enforce old laws, we will not allow, in the case of the U.S., we will not allow individual states to tinker with their own approach to this kind of regulation, so they're preempted from having it. We're just going to create this umbrella and say, no law here, we're going to let it develop and see what it can do before we start figuring out what does and doesn't work.
We're talking with Larry Downs, author of the book The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age, on Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM Stanford. Larry, let's one of the major issues, at least focusing a lot of people's attention, although you may not think it's ultimately, as a practical matter, as big a deal, is network neutrality. And this is something that's of particular interest right now, as the Federal Communications Commission has opened up a rulemaking proceeding to determine ultimately what rules might ultimately be promulgated by the FCC under its questionable, but certainly authority, to promulgate rules in this area. Your view on network neutrality is interesting, and I think it bears, again, some basic definitional issues for those that aren't familiar. What is, as you see it, the issue involving network neutrality, and what is your position with respect to the FCC's role here?
So, the basic idea, which, by the way, I'm fully in agreement with, is that what really has made the Internet successful as a network platform for all kinds of new interactions and collaboration is that it is what we might think of as an open network. The protocols themselves aren't proprietary. Anybody can use them. Any device that supports TCP/IP can be an Internet device. We don't have, you know, strict hierarchies the way we did in the old days of computing networks under IDM and DEC and AT&T. So the principle is right. The idea of net neutrality is to use the law to ensure that broadband access providers in particular don't change that model on the last mile. So the way you relate now to your cable company or your phone company, who may also be, of course, your internet provider, is, you know, the cable company decides what content you see. They charge you based on what content you get, and they charge the content providers themselves, the television programming producers, based on what content they're going to put out over their pipe. And so that last mile can indeed become kind of a bottleneck. And the concern is that given the expense of building internet infrastructure, that the providers will also start to infer that sort of influence on the content that comes forth back and forth over the internet. They may start charging more, say, to Google, which I just read recently is now accounts for about 10% of all internet traffic altogether is coming from or going to Google.
Wow.
They may start to try to impose the kind of restrictions on Google content or make them pay premiums or charge extra that might happen today, for example, with cable television programming. So that's a concern. My position on net neutrality, which is consistent with my position on everything else in the book, is that it's a very bad idea to regulate ahead of a problem. So we have some examples, fairly minor and fairly ham-fisted, of internet access providers messing around with content and, you know, throttling some applications or blocking some applications. But by and large, there's no really serious bottleneck problem yet. And I think regulating ahead of a problem, very dangerous, again, when the technology is evolving as quickly as it is and the regulatory process and undoing mistakes made in the regulatory process is as slow as it is. In particular, I think the FCC is probably, you know, one of the worst places to start innovating in law. Historically, it's, you know, this is still, after all, the agency that you know, watches television programming to make sure the content is decent. And in fact, all they've done over the last several years is to become more prudish about that, more fines. You know, of course, the courts have been trying to rein them in, but, you know, the $550,000 fine for the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl case, this is the FCC. They're not the sort of people you want to be put in charge of making sure that content is not tinkered with, because one of the things that will happen as they try to enforce network neutrality is that they'll be looking at content. And the temptation, I think, for this particular agency will be very high indeed to start looking at ways that they can manipulate or otherwise influence the content that they're now giving themselves authority to keep open. They're going to start looking at it in ways that we will come to, I think, regret.
This is a very controversial area, and I do want to, not your position necessarily, but the whole issue of network neutrality, I do want to push back a little bit and flesh out some of these arguments. You speak about the law throughout the book. The law is not keeping up with these technological changes. So is there any merit to the argument that this is precisely the time for the FCC to regulate? Once we have an inkling of what the problem will be before it becomes one that is more pervasive and potentially more becomes entrenched in the values of the architecture, if you will, in what the internet looks like, isn't this, in fact, the best time, arguably, for a regulatory body to get involved, assuming that it's going to regulate? And I think my assumption personally is that eventually they will. So without expressing my own personal opinion, what about the argument that says this is the time to do it before it becomes a law of disruption?
Well, there's regulation and there's regulation. I mean, there's regulation by traditional regulatory bodies of sort of, you know, the industrial world. I think that almost assuredly whatever they do will turn out to be the wrong thing, and it will have unintended, unexpected negative consequences. But there's also, you know, there's also regulation in the broader sense of the network itself, the architecture of the internet, the code of the internet. It has its own ways of regulating. Again, how, say, the protocols are themselves developed, TCP/IP, how the internet is structured, is a series of regulations not coming from, you know, the FCC or the European Union or other sort of old world bodies of law, But in its own kind of organic way, the Internet has done an exceptionally good job as a technology infrastructure of developing its own kinds of regulation and its own methods for solving problems. You know, we run out of IP addresses, we have naming problems on domain names, all those kinds of issues. They have managed, I think so far, the engineers and the users have done a pretty good job of regulating themselves. We don't necessarily, you know, it doesn't show up in the code of federal registry in a way that, that the traditional law does, but it is a kind of regulation. I have more faith, and I think it really comes down ultimately to a matter of faith, I have more faith that regulation of that variety will do a much better job of solving any bottleneck problem in terms of Internet access than a rulemaking and enforcement by the FCC.
We're talking with Larry Downes, author of the book, The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age, on KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. Larry, we have about 7 minutes left, and you know, as always, it's difficult to cover even a few of the issues in adequate depth in our time period. But I do want to quickly change subjects, not change subjects, but change our focus to another maxim, an argument that is pervasive in your book. You point out towards the end of the book that, and this is a quote, that the best way to regulate innovation is to leave it alone. And I think throughout this conversation, you've taken a very strong position on ultimately letting the technology and letting the Internet solve its own problems. But given that view, do the recent economic disasters that we face suggest that perhaps we do need more regulation in the Internet? In other words, do the economic problems that we've faced as a world over the last couple of years that have been laid to bear based upon a series of poor decisions made by regulators over the last 20 years suggest that perhaps we need a little bit more regulation, paradoxically, that we need a little bit more control and proactive thought to prevent the Internet from going the way of, let's say, AIG and becoming a ultimately privatized behemoth that does not in any way encapsulate the values of network neutrality or any other that involves freedom of speech and thought?
Yeah, I guess I don't I don't take my analogy too far in the sense that when I say the best way to regulate innovation is to leave it alone, I am talking about innovation. In the sense that I won't expand beyond saying that when it comes to disruptive technology, the mismatch between traditional forms and traditional speeds of regulation and the rapid development of the technology is why the mismatch is as strong as it is. I don't have a crazy libertarian view that says all regulation of everything is bad. There shouldn't be traffic laws, and there shouldn't be regulation of
stop signs. Don't bother you. Stop signs don't bother you.
Sorry?
Stop signs don't bother you on the road.
Exactly. Yeah I don't take that. I don't go quite that far. I'm really talking here specifically and only about the regulation of innovation, and particularly of new information technology. That's where I see the biggest mismatch between kind of, you know, efforts to regulate it always backfiring, always having unintended consequences, and or just being ignored. Again, the more the copyright mafia keeps expanding its own power and giving itself longer copyright and more exclusive rights and more enforcement opportunities and bigger fines, the more power they give themselves, ironically, the more irrelevant the law of copyright becomes. And so in some sense, you know, even if we get more regulation of information products and services, that may do nothing more than speed up the ultimate collapse of that old body of law rather than holding back the future at all.
You mentioned Section 230 earlier, the section of the otherwise struck down Communications Decency Act that has generally been credited with the explosion of innovative technologies involving speech, and yet it is an offshoot, as I mentioned, of a law that was found ultimately unconstitutional. With that bizarre paradox, which I think is an example that proves your rule. As we look forward here in the last 4 or 5 minutes. Other than network neutrality, what do you see as the major issues where the laws of disruption will ultimately be tested?
Probably the two biggest that we haven't really said much about. One is the law of personal information or the law of privacy. This is obviously something that is of great anxiety provoking for consumers today for understandable reasons. And the other, of course, as we've hinted at, is the law of intellectual property, copyrights and patents in particular, but also trademarks and open source software in a lesser degree. Those are big, big problem areas. Lots of things are happening. Lots of experiments are being tried. Lots of legislation and litigation is pending that may or may not help or harm or speed up or slow down the transition of those bodies of law to something more useful or more organic to our information life. But those are probably, the two biggest other areas involved.
And in terms of those particular areas, how do you see things winding up in the next 3 or 4 years? The ultimately unfair crystal ball question that I tend to ask towards the end of interviews. Do you have a fearless prediction as to how the law is going to deal with those two major areas?
Yeah, I think, well, I do. I don't have a whole lot to base it on, but my sense is that we will work out the privacy problem. It may not be in 3 or 4 years, but I think what will happen is, again, as information becomes a kind of commodity in this new economy, in the economy of our digital lives, we'll realize that consumers have certain proprietary interest in that value creation and that the businesses have certain proprietary interest. And instead of talking about invasions of privacy and making it all very personal, I think we'll realize that what we've got is value. And that the way in which we exchange that value, there's a market, if you will, for the exchange of personal information, where it's useful for me to sell it, I will sell it. Where it's useful for you to buy it, you will buy it. And I think a lot of the kind of anxiety around it will dissipate as we realize, it's really not about kind of some existential sense of who I am so much as who's deriving value unfairly from something they did or didn't create or didn't add value to. So I think privacy will work itself out. It'll turn out to be a market for information. Consumers will flex their increasingly their power to influence law in that way, and we will get a working market, probably one with very low transaction costs, given that everything's going to be done digitally. On intellectual property, again, my sense is that the copyright system essentially is a system in name only. There's really no serious thought that it's working and that it can be made to work in its present form. The patent system, from a business standpoint, is even more broken. Everybody's unhappy with it, even the big patent holders. And I think we need to take a serious step. I'm not advocating the abolition of either of those systems, but they're both in need of dramatic reform of the kind that no legislator here or abroad is talking about. It's all kind of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic so far. But if that law is to remain useful or even viable as a body of law, we need to see some very large reforms of both.
We are talking with Larry Downes, author of the book The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age, published by Basic Books. Larry, you're a prolific writer and blogger. I would be remiss not to ask two questions. First, where can people go to learn more about your book and your work, and what is your next project?
Well, the first one's easy. The website that I have for all my work is www.larrydowns.com, and that includes my blog and information about the book and pretty much anything having to do with my activities in this area. Next project, I'm really not sure. I have a couple of ideas in mind. One of them is to take a closer look at Schumpeter's work and try to see how it really does influence the ways in which companies in the midst of disruptive change ought to think about strategic planning. The literature of strategic planning is extremely thin, and most of it very academic and theoretical. so there may be an opportunity here to do something much more pragmatic and practical. I may pick that up, or, you know, I don't know. I may just keep writing about net neutrality until I'm carried off to my grave.
There we go. Larry Downs, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and coming back, and I certainly look forward to having you on the show again in the future to continue this discussion. Thank you for your contributions.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on the show in our remaining couple of minutes here. Among guests that will continue our discussion in these areas are Professor Alex Halavay of Quinnipiac University, author of the book Search Engine Society. I'm very excited to have on next year, but I'll mention it here, Professor Manuel Castells, who is a prolific writer, perhaps the most prolific writer in communications in the world. And I'm very excited to have on Professor Castells, who will be on the show discussing his most recent book, Communication Power. So that's very exciting, and I look forward to having Professor Castells on the show next year. I'm also going to have Chris Kelty on, another professor, author of the most recent book, Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software. Kazis Varnalis from Columbia University will be on discussing his book, The Infrastructural City. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, Geert Loving, the media critic and theorist, will be on discussing his book, Zero Comments. Professor Tarleton Gillespie, another fellow of mine from Cornell University, who will be on discussing his book, Wired Shut. I'm also going to be chatting with several other guests coming up for the remainder of the year, including Professor Wendy Chun of Brown University, as well as Professor Frank Pasquale and Daniel Citron, who will be on the show discussing their work on fusion centers. Looking forward to chatting with Professor Bobby Qual from DePaul University School of Law and her most upcoming book on moral rights, in fact, in copyright law. Also, we'll be chatting with Laura DeNardis, author of Yale University, author of a book on technology and infrastructure and how government deals with these issues. Subha Ghosh will be on the show next year, as well as Professor Siva Vaidyanathan from University of Virginia discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything. I am very also excited to mention that I am booking guests for next year on top of the guests that are already here. So if you have any suggestions for guests that I should be chatting with and that you'd like to hear from, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can listen to the show live on KZSU at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. You can also get the show by podcast at hearsayculture.com or through the Center for Internet and Society's iTunes page by going to the iTunes search engine, and also through the Center for Internet and Society's homepage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.